Pamela said, we're from Chicago, and tonight there is no Subway World Series between the Chicago Cubs and the Chicago White Sox because they lost. You probably are familiar with the way baseball teams trade players. You get a swap a second baseman for an outfielder and all that kind of stuff. But as a segue to Joni's excellent presentation, the United States is stealing health workers from abroad, and in return, we're sending them medical tourists. All right? My colleague, soon to be Dr. Aruru, and I will tag team this, but we started this research on the medical tourism after we looked at medical and pharmaceutical outsourcing to India. And we have a manuscript that was published in a journal of pharmaceutical finance, marketing, and management that if you give me your business card, we can download to you. That gives a great deal of detail, but this is going to be our agenda. We prefer to call it health tourism, although the news media has really picked up on the medical tourism idea. But it's basically traveling abroad, for purposes of getting some kind of health care. That could be surgical or other kinds of treatments. It could also be obtaining pharmaceuticals or alternative medicines, indigenous health care, things like that. But it's always for the purpose of getting something cheaper, all right, because it is much, much less than the money that we have in the U.S. You may be familiar with the fact that the United States has had a number of people coming to rich people from around the world coming here to get our, quote, top quality health care. From the Shah of Iran, who went to the Cleveland Clinic, to Bishop Tutu from South Africa, who received care at Emory University. If you're from the New York area, know that a lot of New York hospitals have done marketing campaigns to Europe and the Middle East to get rich people to come here and make some money. And it's all predicated on medical tourists having the ability to pay, and it's usually almost always out of pocket. It's estimated that there are about 150,000 Americans traveling abroad for health care currently, and in a couple years, it's estimated that the worldwide medical tourism expenditure may reach as high as $6 billion. Our health care is market driven, that's why it's so damn expensive. And people who are uninsured, underinsured, or just want to have a holiday away can go abroad and get health care. Also, in national health programs, rich people do not like being in a situation of waiting in a queue or, again, want a holiday, a medical holiday. So these are some of the areas. And it's surely not all of them. Mexico is a preferred location. I've spent a good deal of time in Thailand. Tremendous medical tourism. But we focused in on India, and basically, it's a popular tourism thing in general, but it's got a long history for the ancient medical systems, Ayurveda, and the yogic traditions and things like that. Medicine in India has developed a long, long time ago and has really reached a pretty high level. Magda was making the point about all these different steel instruments in surgery that came long before a lot of surgery in the European tradition. And this, dear children, is India, the mysterious land of tigers, snake charmers, doctors, and engineers. India is low cost. English is a second language. All the health workers, can speak very good. What? It's what? almost the first language. I'm being corrected. I'm sorry. Their private sector has developed rather rapidly, and of course, this is, you know, people coming in with money to pay. There's a good deal of effort for the accreditation. I've done some work with the Joint Commission International, and they've been accrediting hospitals all over the world, a lot in India and in China. And tourists, rich people who have bucks, don't mind traveling abroad and having a nice medical holiday. Trade and health services, as you may know, and Joni may mention a little bit of this, comes from the WTO founding and the GATS agreement, and the Uruguay round ended up amending this. But basically, there's four modes of health services trade, and you can read them right there, and I'll just mention a little bit quicker. Developing countries are interested in the first and second modes, these two in terms of the supply services and the trade and tourism. And the developing countries are interested in commercial presence in the foreign countries and movement of employees internationally. And these are the contentions that you see in some of the fights around health services trade in the WTO circles. Developing countries are very much interested in increased access for their own people. The brain drain that we just got an excellent presentation on. The need for better regulation and enforcement. In many of these developing countries, you'll get bureaucratic regulation that's on the books. The question is, what is ever done about it and the unevenness of the application? And then the educational standardization. India has rapidly grown, as you know, in terms of an economy and in the service sector, most notably in information technology, but their industrialization and economic growth is remarkable. Even today, they're doing well in terms of a lot better. All the last decade, they beat out Bush every year in terms of percentage of GDP increased. And as one of the fastest growing economies and one that is projected within a decade or so, along with China, to overtake the U.S., it offers a lot of attractiveness in every way, shape, or form. And telecommunications, safety, and transportation are areas. Obviously, there has been a lot of changes as India has advanced. People have better access to drinking water. Housing is improved. Banking facilities are improved. The country is really moving forward with a lot more consumer products. And the government is constantly trying to liberalize trade, and there are a lot of tax benefits for multinational corporations and business in general. It's a stable economy and not like some other places where investments of corporate entities are at risk, and they're increasing their judiciary system, although they got a lot to deal with. Okay, I'll turn this over to my colleague, Dr. or soon to be Dr. Ruru. All right.
Good afternoon, everyone. Just before I get started with this, I'm curious, apart from our sleeping colleague out there in the fourth row, who else has been to India? I know, I just mentioned you. But I'm kidding. So as most of you know, India was under British rule for about 100 years, and then there was independence in the 1947. And why am I telling you this? It's because from the period after independence up to about, say, the 1970s was a period of very rosy optimism. There was this huge initiative to get the public health infrastructure in place, and so that was actually done. However, from the 1970s, the market started taking over and the private industry started taking over. The economy sort of stagnated for a while. So from about the 70s to about the early 2000s, or actually even a little before that, we saw the rise of breaking patents by the pharmaceutical industry, a lot of generics, so the generic industry rose. And this went hand in hand with the medical side as well, where private hospitals started gaining prominence, and there was increased out-of-pocket spending for healthcare. The private sector spending is very strong in India as compared to the public sector. It's 4.2% of the GDP. In the public sector, it's only 0.9%. In terms of payer mix, how do people pay for their health care? Out of pocket is about 82%, and these figures are from about, say, 3 or 4 years ago, but I doubt that a lot has changed since. Employers contribute about 9% of that spending, and then health insurance is about 5 to 10%. And that is not to say that health insurance didn't exist in India, it's just that it hasn't really gained prominence the way it has in other countries. Hospitals are getting corporatized. A lot of them are actually getting accredited by the Joint Commission International, which is the international arm of the CHECO. However, the public providers are terribly understaffed and overwhelmed. Indian physicians are traditionally seen as competent because of the earlier exodus to Western countries. I'm pretty sure that most of you have seen an Indian physician in your lifetime here in the United States. And physicians, or being a doctor, is the most respected and trusted profession in India. So the education standards for most universities were relatively high. There's significant cost savings for Western tourists to go to India. And again, these figures, again, are from maybe 3-4 years ago. As you can see, bone marrow transplants can cost up to $200,000 in the U.S. Same for the U.K., but in India, they can cost up to $25,000, and then so on and so forth for the other procedures. The question is, how sustainable is this process of people just traveling abroad and getting their treatments? It actually depends on a lot of factors, but two prominent factors would be accreditation and then insurance coverage. A lot of people who are traveling from either the United States or the UK would like to have some of their expenses covered by their insurance when they travel abroad. And that would be really nice. There's this concept of traveler's insurance, which I'm sure many of you have heard of, but it doesn't pay for pre-existing conditions. Again, there's limitations with that. It's very difficult to negotiate payment of services with independent providers. There's some corporatization, but there's not a lot in India. And managed care organizations are exploring options to see if they can actually start doing that. In terms of the public health infrastructure, there are several health crises that are going on simultaneously in India. You've probably heard about the HIV/AIDS crisis, which is very, very high in India. The figures kept on going back and forth for a few times, and there were these, I think it was at one point somebody said 5 to 6 million, but then apparently that was double counting. So this is the figure I plucked out of the UNAIDS thing, about 2.1 to 3 million cases. In terms of airborne diseases, tuberculosis kills 500,000 people each year. There are waterborne diseases, cholera and typhoid, non-communicable, which are not even addressed in the healthcare system, heavy metal chemical poisoning, and then chronic diseases that are more prevalent in Western countries, but we're seeing a rise in India right now. In terms of population, it's very skewed, and as Joni mentioned on the Philippines thing, here I would say about 5 to 10% would be in the very high elite rich population, but there is a huge middle class, and then there is a huge lower class, lower income category as well. And India ranked 171 out of 175 countries when they were looking at percentage of GDP spent on the public health sector. However, it ranked 17th on private health sector spending. So this is a huge disparity. Again, we talk a lot about tourists going to India or any other developing country, but what it does is it actually causes internal, what is known as brain drain. It drains physicians, nurses, healthcare providers from the public sector and puts them into the private sector. A physician in a government or a public health clinic would probably make about $100 to $400 a month. And a private sector physician, and these are U.S. dollars, so would make about $6,000 to $12,000 a month. And that's living in India. That's a very, very good income. There is an increasing trend for public health practitioners to also own private practices. So the amount of time that they spend in public health clinics is actually significantly has decreased over the years. There was a creation of an autonomous public health foundation in 2005, which is pretty late to get started on that, but there has been some slow progress, and Just to mention, the field of public health didn't officially exist in India, so there were no schools or anything. They are only recently beginning to start MPH programs, and they'll probably move on to the PhD in either epidemiology or health policy. Some other issues that need to be considered within the country itself are sanitation issues, hygiene, roads, transportation. These are some of the things that have often been referred to in the literature. These are the health policy issues within India. There's talk about public-private partnerships, but few of these have actually ever been successful. And one of the examples was a leprosy campaign that came about a few years ago. It was a public-private partnership and very, very successful. But how much of this is actually going to happen in the future? And I'm very concerned with the HIV/AIDS epidemic because we haven't seen a lot of these partnerships coming about. In terms of primary care, there's a lot of specialization to tertiary care, primarily because medical tourism started out for reconstructive surgeries, mostly for elective surgeries. And so there was a lot of specialization in tertiary care. This takes away a lot of physicians from primary care activities. However, the numbers are not that bad. The World Health Organization in 2004 estimated that there were 60 physicians, about 80 nurses, 56 pharmacists, and 5 community health workers per $10,000 people in the public sector. There's also a lot of talk about standardizing the medical education. There's no accreditation of medical education or universities so far, even though there are some very, very good quality, very high quality universities. There's no standardization. So care in one state could actually really differ from care in another state. And this is a really, really scary phenomenon. There are professionalization and legal issues such as malpractice, insurance. What do you do if you're hurt? I mean, you traveled abroad and then you got hurt. Credentialing of healthcare professionals so you know that you're getting some sort of standard care. And then lastly, I just wanted to make a little point about the health tourist. And we talk a lot about tourism, outsourcing, the workers running around, and things like that. But it's also important to talk a little bit about the person who actually seeks this care. Supposed to be a neoliberal citizen because of the supposed ability to make informed choices. There's this lure of exotic destinations when you opt for a medical service or a health service in another country. It's usually bundled together with some sort of travel package. And then it's the idea of trying out new experiences. However, how travelers actually choose these hospitals or services or what are the criteria implied, it's not very clear. It might be highly influenced by the marketing that's employed by some of these agencies, travel agencies, and so on and so forth. So it's very necessary to have internal hospital ratings as well as some sort of accreditation, standardization of care, quality and cost. And so this is what the world looks like to somebody who wants to travel for medical purposes. There's the Thailand hospital saying we're the most competitively priced, Malaysia saying we have the best of everything, and Singapore saying we have the best doctors. But how do you really choose from all of these? And so some of our suggestions for India particularly are basically developing the field of pharmacy and professional healthcare. Why? Because I have a bachelor's in pharmacy. Now, that's not just why I put that in, but it's very important to recognize that pharmacists can fulfill a lot of gaps left behind between physicians and nurses and other healthcare organizations. Some sort of timely responsiveness to the brain drain, not only internal, which is basically the movement from the public to the private sector, but also external, where people are actually moving out of the country, seeking better jobs and better lives. Upgrading existing public facilities, the ones that are out there. In the state where I come from, they were pretty decent. But I've traveled all over, and some of the states have horrible public facilities, which really, I don't want to discuss that. And then also create some sort of public health sector employment. Again, this is what really concerns me with the creation of the Public Health Foundation. Giving out degrees and training people is not going to be enough if there's no jobs out there. So my suggestion is basically create a public sector first and then educate people in there, or at least do some sort of simultaneous process where people who are coming out would actually train other people but then work in the sector at the same time. And then increased research and development for pharmaceuticals, basically for neglected diseases. There's a lot of diseases in the world that are not actually researched. And so this is actually where I will end this. And this, thank you in all different languages. So thank you very much.
We have time for one or two questions for Dr. Zaruhu and Salmon. Does anybody have a question? Ellen.
Hi there. I'm Ellen Schaefer from the Center for Policy Analysis and Creative Health. And appreciate whatever you're saying. Sorry I was late. But my questions, you both referred to the General Agreement on Training Services and sort of indirectly to the TRIPS Agreement and its influence on pharmaceutical R&D. And I'm wondering, with the basic evaporation of the global economy and the call for a very true round of discussions, what you see as a useful approach to revamping those two agreements, and maybe a corollary most relevant to this discussion, whether you think it makes sense to continue to locate the international body just looking at the movement of health personnel in the World Trade Organization.
Okay, I'm really sorry. I actually didn't hear the whole of it. But with regards to the TRIPS agreement, it's actually the patenting laws are in place in India right now. So that's a whole different discussion, I suppose, because there was this whole thing about bringing in patents in place and things like that. With regards to movement of health personnel, well, first of all, there's no standardization of the hospitals and of the physicians themselves. So even though thousands and thousands of people might actually graduate each year, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're qualified to practice. And so this whole thing that I've been saying about standardization and accreditation, and I think it would be very helpful even for people who are moving outside the country, but the government responsiveness to this should be to basically put a cap on how many people they're going to send out of the country and try to retain more people into the public sector. And that's only going to happen if they increase the public sector spending from 0.9%, which is very low right now. So did I answer that? Sort of dead. Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
What types of services are health tourists actually seeking in India? And the second part of that question is, how do you do follow-up care for patients when they come back to the U.S. and who does that?
For the first part...
How does it get paid for? And how does it get paid for?
Well, the first part is basically a lot of elective surgeries. That's how it started out. But a lot of essential treatments as well. So the bone marrow transplants, the coronary bypass. But it's mostly medical. So it's mostly surgery and things like that. And also seeking some sorts of traditional or herbal care in India. That's what probably I think tourists travel for. But the coming back, the follow-up, I'm actually not sure that even happens. So I don't actually think it happens, but I mean, I wish it would, but do you have to say something about it?
No. This is a really critical policy concern because there are a number of employers and insurance companies that are thinking about, hey, we could save some money and we'll send somebody away, and it's being looked at and considered by a number of firms. I'm trying to get some of that together for the American Health and Drug Benefit Journal. But the issue is, you know, what does the insurance company say if you go back, if you do that on your own and then you come back and you're looking for follow-up care for coronary artery bypass or, you know, again, a lot of these surgical procedures that require continued care. And for chronic disease problems, that you're not basically cured, right? You gotta continue on and on and on with the sequelae of the disease. That's one of the areas that are gonna be worked out. And again, tourists have risks in going away if they don't know about the quality. They can't assure that there's gonna be competent care. And then coming back in terms of how they're going to handle the follow-up, you know, does your cardiac surgeon, who you just said, the hell with you, I'm going abroad, you know, to get the procedure faster, cheaper, whatever, does he want to go ahead and take care of you? And how does that get handled by an insurance company that's saying, hey, you know, you're in a more vulnerable situation today, and why should we foot the bill for something that was done elsewhere? These are all issues that have to be worked out, and I don't know how the experience is going to go. I think it presents a lot of risk to people who are traveling abroad.
Actually, the final comments lead us very well into our third presentation. We've had two very powerful presentations, and our third presentation is Medical Tourism, a Union Response. And we have a response from the steelworkers. I'd just like to thank David Kins, whom I'm about to introduce, for stepping in to cover this important topic for the steelworkers really at the 11th hour. We're very grateful because Gary Hubbard, who is scheduled in the program, was unable to join us today. So let me just introduce him quickly. David Kins is the sub-district director, District 12 of the steelworkers, which is responsible for the staff and about 15,000 United Steelworkers members in California. District 12 encompasses California and 11 western states that include Alaska and Hawaii. He's been a USW member since 1972 when he began work at an Illinois metals plant. He's an experienced negotiator and troubleshooter who has a reputation of never giving up when it comes to representing union families. He was appointed to the International Union staff in 1985 to service and negotiate for local unions in Illinois until being named as sub-district director in 1993 when he took an assignment in Pueblo, Colorado. He currently lives in the Los Angeles area and serves as the United Steelworkers sub-district director for California with responsibilities for administering the staff team and representing the steelworkers membership employed in the state's diverse workforce of oil refining, hospitals, and industrial workers employed in steel and metal fabrication plants. Dave is the steelworkers District 12 safety and health coordinator in 11 western states. He also leads the steelworkers Long Beach Medical Hospital negotiating team. Dave arrives at the APHA panel directly from supporting the steelworkers' election 08 efforts in Colorado, known in political circles as a battleground state. We can call Dave Kins an experienced union leader and activist. So please join me in welcoming Dave Kins.
Thank you. I'll just leave the Dr. Rue's picture up there because I don't have a PowerPoint for you. And I'd just like to thank you. Who would have thought in 2008 in this century that we'd be talking about globalizing doctor's care, doctor's surgeries, the medical care in this country? You heard that in 1972 I was in an aluminum plant. In the late 70s or early 80s, we were given the alternative HMOs as a option, strongly recommended by our government that we should take those options. And this century, it's one of our mandatory health care plans that we wind up at the bargaining tables. And I should have said when I started, I bring you regards from President Girard. Steelworkers, we have 1.2 million members and retirees in the U.S. and Canada. President Girard, we first, why is the steelworkers involved in this? Our first exposure to global medical tourism was in 2006 in Evergreen Packaging in District 9, where the company had negotiated with an employee to go overseas to have some surgery, and we interceded in that and stopped. And many of the questions that have come about what happens to the follow-up care, what happens to that employee when he comes back to the U.S., and what if that employee is not able to do his job or her job, what happens to that employee? So we need to think about each and every one of those situations, because this turn of the century and globalized economy is now turning into globalized medicine. Unions should not allow this. They should not allow the individual bargaining without the employees knowing what the full impacts are, what the liabilities are. The U.S., as you many of you know, have 45 million uninsured people in this country, millions more that are underinsured. We need to fix the problem, not ship it off overseas. And I put down here the Americans need to get their heads out of the sand and quit ignoring the U.S. healthcare system and fix it. Don't contract out our healthcare. I have an example from the New York Times, August 14, 2008, a story of Maria Hernandez, a working-class American who traveled to Delhi to get a hip replacement. She could not afford to get back home. She and other medical tourists die in mysterious circumstances. She didn't come home. That could be your spouse. That could be your grandparents. It could be your child, if you so chose to do that. We need to really be careful. I'm thinking that the glamour of going to a foreign country, going to a Costa Rica, to be treated or have surgery done because it's a nice tourist place, we really need to be seriously concerned. It also says in that New York article that 750,000 medical tourism in the year, last year, there's supposed to be 6 million anticipated by 2010, 10 million by 2012. Where are our jobs going to go? Where are our doctors going to go for U.S.? There are success stories, and that's why I guess we're here today. There's people that have had heart bypass surgeries, come home successful. But how many of the Mrs. Hernandez's have we got that we don't hear about or we don't read about? That may never come home, or may wind up in another country. The other problem we have in the U.S., when that person comes back to the U.S. and has complications, many doctors will not treat that problem depending on the surgeries, depending on the complications. I know a person that had gastroplastic surgery, that the doctor would not touch that person. The only recourse then is to either go back to that country to try to get fixed or die. So does medical tourism mean it's going to fix our healthcare system? That answer is no. People that label the unions that we fight for national healthcare to be something other than Americans, to be socialists, when the real problem is globalization of healthcare is costing us good-paying American jobs, all of them. Medical transcriptionists, my wife is a medical transcriptionist. Her job has been contracted out to India. I currently have a daughter-in-law going to nurses' school. It's because her other job was eliminated. We need to create good American jobs. We need to save our doctors. And I'll say that Dr. Aru talked about Indian doctors. My wife worked for Dr. Sunku. And the other Dr. Sunku run the office, and they were excellent doctors, and they're here in America. No citizen in the nation should be exposed to risk involved in a forfeiture of rights of malpractice or inappropriate care. The other thing when people are choosing these medical tourisms, what recourse do they have if there's malpractice or if there's inappropriate care in that country? Who will be responsible? How will that be adjudicated? The unsanitary conditions, the pictures we see are by the best and the most well-kept facilities. what other facilities might you get sent to if you were in one of these foreign countries? We think there's a lack of oversight by our trusted organizations, by our governments, by our employers. Every negotiator, when they get to the bargaining table, whether it's a local union person or whether it's the international staff, should ensure that when they talk about the health care that's being provided to our members, that it also protects their rights, keeps them from being trapped into this glamorous thought of global medical tourism. You also heard Joni talk about the nurses to patient ratios. In the U.S., they're already out of control. Nurses are 1 to 20, 1 to 30, 1 to 40. The CNAs, the nurses' assistants, are one person for every 3-4 nurses, so that patient number just goes up. Negotiators need to guarantee our members, your children, that we don't give away our American jobs, and that we need to stop outsourcing America. Thank you. Next presentation. I hit something.
Do we have a question or two for Dave?
Yes, sir.
Okay. One, I want to thank Steelworkers for putting some organizational time and effort into fighting for HR 676, the United States National Health Insurance Act, which is our national health care plan. And then, maybe this, I don't think this is exactly for you, but it's for all of you. I read an article that was in the Memorial Day week issue of 2006. But it had an article about medical tourism and how the insurance industry was figuring out how to market this stuff. That they could, you know, save you some money, and they were figuring out, let's see now, if not everyone who wanted to go to some other country to get their procedures done. But then they said, we found that maybe if we sent a relative with them, they could bring some along for free, that way it might be worth flying. But they found that they gave like $1,100 of spending money. That was a tipping point to get people to go. And I can see it coming up in union negotiations where some insurance company comes in there and says, if you agree to send so many people overseas, we'll keep the rates the way they are right now. But I can see that coming, and I'm scared that it'll be more than $6 billion. I can see this coming. So that's coming. Okay. Now I have a question about what demand on this stuff. I'm in San Francisco. On June 19th, the American Health Insurance Industry thought they could come to San Francisco and have a convention. We could put 3,000 people on the streets. And the demand was simple. Healthcare, yes, insurance companies, no. And then in September, the medical tourism industry had a convention in San Francisco of like 700 people or something. And I wanted to put 1,000 people off the street. I couldn't figure out the demand. So if you were going to demonstrate at the medical tourism convention, what would you put on your banner? You can't give a paragraph on these talks. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, national health care, save lives, stop medical imperialism. I don't know what. What would you put on your banner? What would be your
Mrs. Hernandez for the first one? I'd put a nice picture of Mrs. Hernandez before she went to India. And then when she didn't come home. I mean, we can do those type of things, but I think the horrific side of this is that there is no malpractice, there is no litigation. If you look at the laws of those countries, it's like some of our military people who get trapped in these other countries, and then we have to negotiate their way home. In this medical care, I see that as the atrocity. And I think there's probably far more examples of Ms. Hernandez than we know about. And I think that the research about the tragedies, both abroad and at home, now she didn't come home. She certainly had family members back here somewhere. that probably have a real story to tell. And I think if we don't let America know where we're headed, globalization of medical care. I've heard the word globalization for years, and we're involved in Globalization International Union so that we can be more in tune to what's happening throughout the world. But I never thought in my lifetime that I would see where it's went in 35 years. And I think the story we need to tell is real stories, people stories. And I think you get people to rally behind you if you have real stories. Pardon?
Thank you, Dave. I just had a comment to make for you as I heard you saying this about Mrs. Hernandez, and I appreciate the situation. But for any of you who have read the Institute of Medicine's To Air Is Human, there's about thousands of Americans who die each year. So I think it's not just the issue of, you know, traveling to another country and dying there, but it's also a matter of looking inwards, looking at the system within here itself. And then in a global economy, how can we translate this into some sort of universal standard of care where basically people are safe to travel around? Globalization has happened whether we like it or not. I mean, coming from a developing country, I'm not a big fan because it takes away a lot of our public sector people, puts them into private sector, and it leaves a vast majority of uninsured, basically they're all uninsured, but vast majority of these low-income populations were just neglected. And this is just terrible. So it's just a market phenomenon. And I'm wondering, what would you suggest?
Okay, that's a fair question. I can give you a paid political announcement. Vote on November 4th. But the truth is, I think that we have to fix through the legislature. President Girard wrote letters to the congressmen and to the U.S. senators in 2006 over this issue. We need to get it engaged in Washington, D.C., and we need to be serious about it, and we need to get the message out. I agree with her. We need to also be concerned about the medical care in the other countries. But we need to make sure we fix it here at home so they don't lose all these doctors. We don't lose these nurses' jobs because all we're doing is outsourcing America. So.
I agree.
Washington, D.C.
We have time for probably one more question. Does anyone have another question or comment? Okay. Well, in that case, at the back of the room, there's information, international... about U.S. healthcare system in international comparison, also information about nurses, and also the Labor Caucus program and Labor Caucus applications. We hope you will join us. And please join with me in thanking our four very fine presenters this afternoon.
Thank you.
Interesting combination. I did. I've got the thing. I'm just going to read it verbatim. Yeah.
Oh, good.
It had to go through a level of.
Yeah.
How did you think of
it?
How did
it go?
PSI.
I got her.
You got it.
Oh, good. Thank you so much for doing this. It was really interesting. I think it was really interesting.
Colorado working.
Yeah. I've been working in Virginia. It's been so
I'm going
many
back,
years.
But I'm,
fun, you know?
Yeah. No, we had 100,000, and I wasn't there because I was on a plane to show for Obama yesterday in Denver.
Yeah, I heard 100,000.
Yeah. I couldn't believe it when he came to Pueblo. I was there, and I counted 15,000 to 20,000. That was about 3 weeks ago. And that's good for Pueblo.
Mm-hmm.
And then Biden came out last week, about 1,000.
I'm afraid to get too excited because, you know, but God, I just don't see how he, I don't want to say it out loud. I'm afraid I'll jinx it.
Well,
but
you know, they've thrown all the mud.
They've not
changed the poll.
Right.
And I don't think I don't think people ever get tired of that crap. I just think they don't believe it.
Yeah.
I think
that's true too.
You know, because you always
oh,
polls come
small
together.
Little, you know, they're a group, you know, loves to hear it, so they'll keep saying it. But
no, but I think, and I don't know why America don't get tired of this.
Yeah, I know. They don't. I know.
And then you hear them talking about it.
I know.
Oh, wait a minute. Now, why aren't you going to vote?
But you know what? I love talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
The whole $150,000 wardrobe.
Oh, yeah.
I love talking about that stuff. So.
Yeah. Oh, Leo helped me in safety when he told people. He said, he put the record side by side.
Oh, yeah.
And you ask your member, why aren't you voting? And they why aren't you voting for
AFT? I have to say that our membership,
I think the AV people may help you.
Republican that I would like to admit.
Mm-hmm.
They have come around this time. I mean, it's just really been phenomenal to see the change in attitudes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we've got some racism. Leo said it's the worst he's ever seen in his whole career. Comments and people that are.
But you know, most of our members also are in urban areas. For better or for worse. Sometimes it makes it worse.
Depends where.
But for the most part.
Yes.
You know,
if I don't know where to put it, this is very sophisticated.
I'll be glad when it's over, but then on the other hand, it's like, I'm only going